my mouth and the meditation of our minds and the love of our hearts be acceptable to you, our rock and our redeemer. Well, you can just see the tabloid headlines, can't you? Stargazers tell their stories. Exotic so-called wise men from Arabia and beyond arrived in Jerusalem. They were seeking a newly born king, and they claimed they'd been following a star. Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east, and we have come to worship him. I mean, how would the wise men tell their story? They spent much time studying the stars, and no doubt seeking to understand the universe and their place within it. Their view of the universe would have been that of the Greek philosophers, who knew something about the planets and the movements of the stars. They knew that the earth was a globe. They knew that the moon went around it. But here, a new star has appeared. Now we might say, well, perhaps it was a comet, or maybe a nebula. But whatever it was, it led them to Jerusalem and to King Herod, and from there to Bethlehem, and a very different king. T.S. Eliot recalls the story in his poem, The Journey of the Magi. Let me just read a couple of verses from that story as Eliot tells it. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year, for a journey, and such a journey. The ways deep, the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on the slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. But anyways, we move to the end of the poem. They arrive at Bethlehem. But there was no information, and so we continued. And arriving at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place, well, it was, you might say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago. I remember, and I would do it again. But set down, this, were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence, and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We return to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation with an alien people touching their gods. Eliot seems to understand that the birth of Jesus changes everything. We return to our places, to these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here. In the old dispensation, the old way of understanding, the old faith, with alien people clutching their gods. Was it now different? They had followed a star and found a king. When Herod asked his wise men in Jerusalem, they quoted the Jewish prophecy about the Messiah. proclaimed in Micah chapter 5. And their star, well, the star the wise men had been following led them to a baby or a toddler in Bethlehem. But is Eliot right? Could they now no longer go back to their old ways of thinking, to their science, to the myths of the gods of the Middle East, of Apsu and Ea and Kingu and Marduk, or the Egyptian god Aten? And what about our modern stargazers, people like Stephen Hawking, who is seeking the mind of God? Well, of course, what Hawking means by seeking the mind of God is he's looking for a mathematical equation that will explain the origin of the universe. Well, then again, there's another cosmologist, Paul Davies, who writes a lot of popular cosmology, wondering when he looks at the patterns in the universe, when he looks at the coincidences that bring together, that have to come together before this universe and this planet and our lives could actually exist. He says, are we truly meant to be here? And this is what he writes. What is man that we might be party to such a privilege? I cannot believe that our existence in this universe is a mere quirk of fate, an accident of history, an incidental blip in the great cosmic drama. Our involvement is too intimate. We are truly meant to be here. Davis, who is at best an agnostic, if not an atheist, says, I do not take life, mind, and purpose without a serious reflection. And I concede that the universe at least appears to be designed with a high level of ingenuity. Although Davis refuses to use the word God. But while he denies being religious, he does believe that life and mind, human life that is, and the human mind, is deeply etched into the fabric of the cosmos. He says, perhaps through a shadowy, half-glimpsed life principle. And if I'm honest, he says, I have to concede that this starting point is something I feel more in my heart than in my head. So maybe, he says, this is where religious conviction begins. So I would ask, along with the wise men, can our modern cosmologists go back to their agnosticism? Can they go back to their cosmological equations and remain unchanged when they've discovered purpose and design in the universe? But of course, we're not mostly scientists, and we have other concerns. And so we turn back to our first reading in Isaiah, a message of hope for those in exile and those who have returned to a devastated Israel, a message for those in darkness, a message for those in fear, in distress. The darkness of an alien land, the fear of oppression and slavery, the distress found by the returning exiles who find the temple and the city of Jerusalem in ruins. It's also a message for the poor, the oppressed and the downtrodden, the returning exiles and the people of the land who were left behind. They weren't taken into exile because they didn't have any value. They were worth nothing at all. They had no influence. And so this is how they must feel. No wealth, no power, their religion in tatters, no hope. But now God addresses them through the prophet Isaiah, with all the prophecies that Isaiah brings about the Messiah. It's a message of hope that God has not abandoned them. And God still speaks to them. It's a message of prosperity and influence. God says that the people from other lands will be drawn to the wealth, power, and religious life of God's people in Jerusalem. It's a message about God, a message about God's purposes for his people and his promises to them. They have a future in God's plan to continue to bring the message of hope to the whole world, not just for themselves, and they are assured by God's promise to bring this about. And this is Epiphany. Hope breaking into the world as God is born into the world. God with us, God's light, God's good news for all people, the fulfillment of God's promises to the Old Testament people. And so we celebrate Epiphany. We celebrate the revealing of God's Messiah to the world. Because Epiphany is God's revelation of the very nature and purposes and promises of God in that baby born in a manger. This is part of the pattern of revelation. As we look at Scripture, particularly as we look at the Gospel, we find the revelation of Jesus as the Messiah. There's the revelation of Jesus' birth to the shepherds, the lowly, despised group in Palestinian society. They weren't allowed to go into the temple because they were unclean. And here we have, in our second reading, the revelation of God's Messiah to Gentiles, astrologers, those who've been studying the stars in distant lands that know nothing of the God of Israel. And of course, we mustn't forget the choosing of Mary to be the mother of Jesus. Young, unmarried, a Jewish peasant girl. And if we think back a few months ago when we were looking at the Gospel according to John, and we read about the woman at the well at Sychar, the very first person that Jesus reveals himself to as Messiah in his adult ministry. So here she is. She's an outcast. She's a member of a hated race as far as the Jews were concerned. She's a Samaritan. And of course she's a woman. She has no influence, no importance in society. And of course we see the unconditional approach of Jesus to an individual, the unconditional acceptance of an individual, whatever the human judgment is of her life, whatever human judgment is of our lives, we still come to one who accepts us as we are. And we find that God shows himself to people in unexpected places and in unexpected ways. A star in the night sky. What do we learn then from the Gospel? No one is outside of God's love. No one is too bad. God reaches out in love and forgiveness to each one of us. No strings attached. We don't have to do something first. We don't actually have to do something before God accepts us. We simply have to trust in his forgiveness and love. And God always goes the extra mile to reveal his love and his truth to us. Think of the ways in which we have come to faith, the way in which we've come to know the Gospel. Think of our philosophers from distant lands, where a star or a comet is sent to guide them hundreds of miles to Jerusalem to see the revelation of God's good news. In Jesus, God speaks to each of us, reaches out to us, gets behind our excuses. God knows us. He knows every painful and bitter experience. He knows every sordid failure, shameful action. And as a loving parent, God offers us love and a new beginning. Excluded perhaps by others, but included by Jesus. Ashamed, but accepted by Jesus. abused by others, but received with compassion by Jesus, despairing about life, but our life given meaning and purpose in the cross of Christ, feeling at a distance from God, but encountered in Jesus. It's the heart of the gospel. We all have value. The gospel is for everyone, whoever we are, and whatever we've done. A message for those in darkness, a message for those in fear, a message for those in distress, a message for the poor, a message for the oppressed and the downtrodden, a message of hope. It's a message about God, God's purposes for our lives, and his promises never to let us go. This is Epiphany. Thanks be to God.